Welcome, everyone. Welcome. I know that a number of people will continue to take their seats as some latecomers straggle in. I'm Steve Heidemann from the U.S. Institute of Peace, and it's a pleasure to have you join us this afternoon at the Carnegie Endowment for this panel on deteriorating politics and social unrest in Egypt. It is a very timely panel, I think you would all agree. I doubt that many of us in the room would disagree that Egypt presents an increasingly disturbing image of a country where the leadership is progressively more determined to resort to coercion as a means for reasserting its control over the Egyptian political arena, where authorities have worked and worked quite effectively in many respects to roll back some of the gains that had been experienced by civil society groups during the period from 2003 to 2005 and to suppress pretty much any and all political challengers, no matter how modest those challengers might be and the degree of threat they pose to the regime, including in particular, of course, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, where we have a presidential transition that seems to be rivaling that of Fidel Castro in duration, that continues to cast a very long cloud, a very dark, deep shadow over the political arena in Egypt, and where a period of economic growth and job creation that Egypt enjoyed over the past several years has very recently given rise to the kind of social unrest from the excluded, the marginal, that segment of Egypt's population that struggles to feed its families, of a kind that we really haven't seen take place in Egypt since at least the late 1970s with the bread riots under Anwar Sadat, and where, despite the willingness of some 250,000 Facebook users to commit to participating in a general strike on May 4th, the 80th birthday of President Mubarak, I think the number of you present in this room exceeds the number of Egyptians who participated in the strike activities that took place in Cairo on the 4th of May, and where finally the sense that the U.S. government is willing or able to use whatever influence, whatever perhaps residual influence it has in Egypt to try to shape the direction of events along lines that we might find more favorable. I think that seems increasingly remote as the tenure of the Bush administration winds to a close. It is not a terribly reassuring picture. It's a picture that I think underscores that this truly is a moment of deteriorating politics and social unrest in Egypt. And we have with us this afternoon, I think, one of the strongest group of Egypt analysts in Washington to help us understand and take stock of these events and put them in perspective. And their viewpoints are reinforced and strengthened by the presence with us this afternoon of Bahiyadin Hassan, the director of the Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies. We are also joined by Michelle Dunn, a senior associate here at Carnegie, who also edits the Arab Reform Bulletin, and by Amr Hamzawi, a senior associate and widely known and highly regarded specialist on Egyptian politics. Each of them will speak for some 10 to 12 minutes in order to ensure that we have ample time for conversation with you. And we very much look forward to hearing what all of them have to say, and we'll begin with you, Bahiyadin, if you don't mind.
Thank you. I think you heard it. Okay. To such exceptional opportunity to exchange views and ideas about what is going on now in Egypt. I am honored to participate in this panel with such distinguished analysts who are well known for their expertise in the Middle East in general and in Egypt in particular. My presentation would address what I considered that Egypt is witnessing now a new momentum. And I think this is the first serious response to the institutionalized state counterattack on the political openings and the mobility which took place during the years of 2004 and 2005. To address such a question, I would go through three or four questions. What we mean by counterattack, state counterattack, the historical significance or historical, in fact, exception of the 6th of April. Third, what is the political forces which participated in the 6th of April? And finally, a final question, is it a moment for Egypt, just a moment, or is it a momentum? Concerning the first question, at the end of 2005, the state launched a very serious and comprehensive counterattack against the political openness or political mobility which took place in 2 years. The targets for these counterattacks were mainly the independent press, the freedom of expression, Kifaya, Muslim Brotherhood, NGOs, and judges. The main objective of this counterattack is to recreate a situation where such political mobility don't come again, don't be repeated. To make such job or attack, there were two tracks, one towards the international community and the second towards the public itself and the internal forces. So the means of these attacks were first, it was legislative and constitutional by making several amendments to laws, several amendments to the constitution. And concerning the constitution itself, it is considered by many constitutional experts as the worst constitution setback in Egypt since July 1952. The second track for this attack is the, and this is surprising maybe, is the judicial attack. I mean by that using the judiciary to help and consolidate these attacks. And in this regard, we witnessed military trials for civilians, trials motivated by NDB members against journalists, also trials, unfair trials for bloggers, judges themselves, and some other public figures. Of course, at the top of them, was Ayman Nour. The third track for this counterattack, it is administrative, and in this regard, Egypt, which has known human rights in NGO since a quarter of a century, since 1983, for the first time in the history of human rights in NGOs in Egypt, two human rights NGOs were shut down in the last 10 or 12 months. The last track for this counterattack is the security, of course, through arbitrary arrest and detention, also zero tolerance towards the right to assemble, the right to express to freedom of express in collective means through demonstrations or public meetings or whatever, and of course continue to practice torture without serious accountability. This is internally the track with the outsiders and with US and the EU. In particular, it was to convince them how much that Egypt has only one alternative for such a situation, which is the Muslim Brotherhood. And this has proved that this is the vital weapon in such a kind of dialogue with US and Europe. Of course, Egypt continue in this regard to serve well the security and the strategic interest of US and Europe in a period with new arising challenges. I mean Iraq, Iran, Lebanon, Gaza, and so on. Now to the second question sub-item with the historical exception of the 6th of April. What happened the 6th of April? And this is contrary to what happened to the 4th of May. In a country where there is almost 50% illiterate, and more computer illiterate, a group of young people were able to mobilize millions of people to react positively to their appeal for sit-in in homes as a signal of social protest against the situation in general. And the slogans in this regard was, of course, the question of poverty, the question of corruption, and also the question of freedom of expression, human rights, and so on. And this was a very illustrative indication of how much the feeling of anger and unsatisfaction with what is going on, whatever the reason, is spread all over the country, to the extent that unknown young people were able to make such an achievement. This is something not done by a well-known political force with a history, with a record, with public figures, with charismatic figures. And the main instrument in this regard is the appeal itself and how it was designed to interact positively and to respond genuinely to the Egyptian context in this in such moment. In this regard, we have to notice that not only the government were against such appeal of the 6th of April, but also almost all the oppositional political parties, including the major ones, the Muslim Brotherhood didn't join this, and they said that, well, they welcome or they appreciate the right to strike and so on, but not to involve in that. Parallel to that, there was also some sort of labor protest or working class protest in El Mahalla El Kubra in particular. The third point is concerning the what we are talking about concerning the 6th of April. The 6th of April, and what is the difference in the future between the political mobility of the 2004 and 2005, and what is happening now in Egypt starting by the 6th of April. There are several differences in this regard. In 2004 and 2005, at the front was Kefaya, Muslim Brothers, judges, and some oppositional political parties. In addition to that, and this is very important to notice, that there was a change in the attitude of the international community, mainly US and Europe, and they mobilized serious pressures on the government to make a reform or to open, or at least to put an, limits for the harassment of the people. The political forces or the main forces of the second of the recent political mobility is the that there are new forces have become at the front, and those are mainly the new generation with different political background, but totally different from the traditional political background of the political activists and the parties of EU. It is a mix between social left and liberals, secularist and so on, and new trend of moderate young Islamists. Such new forces are supported, as we witness, by the independent press, the electronic media, and behind, far from the front, are kefaya, judges, and human rights NGOs. The third feature for the third difference, that this movement, the first one was mainly or only political movement. This one, it is political social movement. The fourth feature, that it is much more less Islamized than the previous one of 2004-2005. And I guess that, as I said, there is a serious shift in the ideological and political background of this movement. Now, as the time is running, I have to jump to respond to the final question or conclusion. Is it a moment, or it is just a moment, 6th of April, and big silence after that, or it is an indication for new momentum? I can't promise to give a concrete answer for that, because I think this is, it is too early to give a concrete answer, but this is will depend on several factors, especially how much the new forces are able to learn from the past experience, not only of the 2004, 2005, but also across 50 years or more than 50 years under July 52 regime. Another important factor also would be decisive in this regard is to how much the Egyptian regime is ready to make a serious revision to its politics based on this enlargement of the social political protest movement. I am not sure, has the regime received the message of the 6th of April? I am not sure. I can't say that such a message has received, has heard, has been heard, has been analyzed well, and necessary conclusions have been generated. I am not sure. There is no indication for me that such messages have arisen. In such context, I think that, context of regime is not able, it has become very clear, is not able to respond to the arising economic minimum needs of the people, and on the other hand, is not ready up till now. Maybe if it will be able to analyze the message of the 6th of April, but up till now, it is not clear that is ready to pay also not only economic price, but also political price. I mean by open the space for the political forces and for the Egyptian people to express themselves, whatever their means. Thank you very much, and thank you again to Carnegie.
Thank you very much, Bahim. Michelle.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Egyptian government's response and the measures that they've taken in response to some of the social unrest. And just to, Behe spoke about the April 6th strike and the May 4th planned strike that didn't materialize, but I just want to place this in a wider context. Of course, there have been labor strikes, labor protests going on for several years now and kind of building in intensity. And then there was also this bread crisis more recently back in March, as you know, in response to the sort of rising global food prices and so forth, what took place in Egypt. So the government, first of all, in response to the bread crisis and to the protests and so forth that took place around that, the government ordered the military to increase the production of subsidized bread and increased the flour rations for a lot of bakeries who were producing subsidized bread. They opened a lot of new kiosks around Cairo for distribution. They carried out government inspections of bakeries to stop smuggling of bread. They suspended rice exports from Egypt for 6 months, beginning in April. And all in all, it was a fairly costly process for the Egyptian government to deal with the bread crisis. It led to an increase in the annual government food subsidy costs by almost a third, by about 30%, from about $10.6 billion to $13.7 billion that the government spends annually on food subsidies. Then there was the general strike of April 6th and the planned strike of May 4th, and that led to another set of measures on the part of the government. And it seemed to be that at the April 6th strike, although it certainly was not a nationwide strike, it was significant enough to, I think, get the government thinking that they needed to take some additional economic measures. And it would seem that there was some concern on the part of the government about the May 4th planned strike. So I would say the Egyptian government adopted what I would call kind of a sandwich strategy, Before the May 4th strike, on April 30th, President Mubarak announced that he was proposing a 30% wage increase for all public sector employees. Now, the public sector employees would have already been expecting an increase probably in July. And although on a normal basis, that increase would have been something like 5%, at least I've seen indications that the government was already planning a larger increase, maybe a 15% increase for public sector employees. But then Mubarak doubled that to 30%. Now, I mean, that's a lot of people believe that's the main reason why the May 4th strike didn't happen, that people had in their pockets this 30% increase for public sector employees. But right after May 4th, on May 5th, then the government started talking about, and now here's what we have to do to pay for this. And they passed, submitted very quickly to the parliament a set of budget measures in order to pay for the public sector wage increase. It was a 64-page report of budget measures that was given to members of parliament, and they had to vote on it that day. And it included removing subsidies on several kinds of fuel, certain kinds of gasoline, diesel, natural gas, raising taxes on cigarettes, removing tax breaks for private schools and universities, raising registration fees for certain kinds of vehicles, SUVs and other luxury vehicles. And they were passed by the parliament that day and implemented immediately. So, in discussing this, the prime minister and other officials highlighted that these were measures that they said were targeting the rich. I mean, they pointed out that they did not raise the price on the level of gasoline that is most often used by poor people, butane, et cetera. So they, at least it was packaged this way publicly. We're going to tax the rich more heavily in order to pay for this wage increase for public sector employees. So just looking at all these measures, I mean, it's quite a lot. I mean, the Egyptian government has really had to dance pretty fast in the last couple of months to keep on top of this situation. And going back to Behe's point about, that we're in a new moment now, I think that's true. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the 2004-2005 period, only in the sense that the government seemed to be reacting a bit to things that were happening either in the society or in opposition movements. And Behe is quite right that right now we see it arising a little bit more out of society, out of labor, out of less organized civil society elements rather than organized opposition groups. This is unlike the period of 2006-2007 when it really seemed that the Egyptian government had the initiative. It was sort of striking back, and that the opposition and other groups were reacting or reeling, in reaction to that. Now, some of the measures that the Egyptian government has taken recently were planned in some sense. I mean, there was already a plan to remove a lot of the fuel subsidies. And as I said, there was already a plan to give the public sector employees a larger increase than usual. And this was part of the economic thinking of the prime minister and others in terms of where they were going. But it definitely seems that the Egyptian government had to do more and do it more quickly. And they really were kind of operating in crisis mode. Now, this is not necessarily, out of fear of the organized opposition. In fact, I think as Behe hinted, there's been some talk about the fact that although the Muslim Brotherhood didn't participate in the April 6th strike, they did say that they were supporting the May 4th strike and that they were, encouraging people, and yet it didn't happen. So I think more the fear on the part of the government or the concern is about the possibility of more widespread social unrest. There's a lot of talk about the 1977 bread riots and how close are we to that kind of a situation now in Egypt and so forth. So I don't mean to suggest that there's necessarily any radical change impending. There's this ongoing cat and mouse game between the government on one hand and opposition, civil society, labor forces on the other hand, which are not cohesive. But I just think we're in a phase right now where the initiative seems to be a little bit out of the hands of the government, as opposed to the last couple of years. And one indication of that, I think, is that some of the government's plans, certain pieces of legislation and so forth it was planning to bring forward, are not necessarily being brought forward. There are several examples of that, which I won't bore you with, but one of them, probably the most important one and the thing to watch for, is the situation with the state of emergency in Egypt and the counterterrorism law. President Mubarak most recently renewed the state of emergency for 2 years in 2006, and it is due to expire this month. He promised at that time that it would not be renewed again, that this was the last time, and that it would be replaced with a more specific counterterrorism law. That law has still not been introduced into the parliament. It's been discussed. There was a constitutional amendment to pave the way for the law, and there was a leaked draft of the law in the independent press that's gotten some discussion and gotten a lot of criticism. But at any rate, it has not been introduced into parliament. It's not really clear what's going to happen now. There's a sense that the situation is a bit volatile, and there are a number of options. The Egyptian government might well do what it has done in the past and introduce the counterterrorism law kind of at the 11th hour and pass it very quickly through the parliament. Certainly it has the votes to do that if it can get the entire, all of the National Democratic Party delegates on board. It can do that, but there is a lot of criticism of this law, so they might pass the law very quickly and lift the state of emergency, and that will probably bring down on the head of the Egyptian government a certain kind of criticism for whatever the law says, and especially if it's passed very quickly, which is very likely if it's passed, that it would be passed without a lot of debate. And then the other possibility is to renew the state of emergency, which will bring a different kind of criticism on the head of the Egyptian government. They probably have to do one of these things or the others. It's possible, but I think it's unlikely that they would let the state of emergency lapse without putting something else in its place. And so we will see what happens with that, and I'll stop there.
Thank you. Amr, please.
Thanks. Let me build on what Bahia and Michelle already shared with you to basically address four issues. In a way, I'm going to focus my remarks on the opposition spectrum. Michelle just presented different government measures and looked at what are the options of the Egyptian government. I'm going to strict myself to the opposition spectrum. But before moving into a set of remarks about organized opposition movements as well as different protest activities, to which Behe and Michelle referred as well, let me just start by saying that when you look at Egypt right now, and here we really have a significant difference when you compare Egypt of 2007 and 2008 to Egypt of 2003, 2004, and 2005. As of now, we are looking at two sets of phenomena which are contradictory and which, in fact, entail a great deal of risks for the Egyptian society, for the stability of Egyptian politics, as well as for the government's ability to manage, to navigate the socioeconomic as well as the political scene. What we are looking at as of now is two sets of phenomena which are interesting to take note of. One, as Steve mentioned, Bahia as well, definitely deteriorating socioeconomic conditions. And here, yes, the government has been performing well economically at a macro level. We are looking at 7% plus economic growth rates over 06, 07, and projected around 8% in 08. We are looking at a macro economic improvement. However, when you look at what really matters for the large segment of Egyptians who are impoverished, marginalized, who have been living under the poverty line throughout the last years, not much has happened. We are looking at an increased unemployment rate, a growing poverty rate. We are looking at a growing inflation rate. In fact, in the last 4 months, January 2008 up until today, over 10%. Of course, it's not simply domestic. There are different international components into it. But we do have a disconnect between a macroeconomic improvement and deteriorating socioeconomic conditions, especially when it comes to impoverished segments of population. Everyone knows that economic growth takes time to trickle down. But it seems to me that the Egyptian government is faced with a very dangerous situation where part of the measures which Michel referred to was a quick adaptation to how to bridge the gap between an improved economic performance and a deteriorated socioeconomic scene. The second set of phenomena, and here once again in contradiction to what happened in 03, 04, and 05, and in contradiction to what happened, how Sadat, for example, reacted in 1977 after the bread riots, or how the Mubarak regime, the government in the 1990s, reacted to different moments of economic crises. If you look now in 2007, 2008, we are looking at a clear trajectory, a broad backslide, as Steve mentioned, when it comes to the political arena. So we have a socioeconomic crisis, deteriorating socioeconomic situation, and a broad backslide in the political arena, which is, as I am saying, is not what Egypt encountered before. Egypt did have in the 1970s, second half of the 1970s, several times in the 1990s, as late as 2003, 2004, we had governments which reacted by opening up the political space slightly to offset major socioeconomic crises. As of now, it seems that for the first time over the last decades, we have the two trajectories running in two different directions. Second general point before I come to the opposition spectrum is, it seemed to many observers and to many of us as well, right after the parliamentary elections of 2005 and looking at the measures which Behaye discussed at the legal level, at government opposition interaction, as well as government civil society interaction, it seemed by the end of 2006 and 2007 as if the Egyptian government was back in charge and strategically ahead, always at least a step ahead of any set of opposition actors. It seems that they were able to bring down the level of political dynamism which we had in 03, 04, 05 down to what we knew back in the 1990s. They seemed once again in charge. Of course, the constitutional amendments represented a key or a milestone. And in general, the wave of repression and restrictions, limitations, which were imposed, as Behaye rightly mentioned, not only on the Muslim Brotherhood, but on different opposition actors and even on the independent press. However, when you look at Egypt of 2008, especially after after April 6, May 4, and without exaggerating the significance of these two incidents, we are definitely once again looking at a government which is no longer in a superior strategic position, which is faced with a social fabric that faces the government with different dilemmas, different problems where they are trying to react, and sometimes they react without a plan. They react without a strategic vision. Part of the measures which Michel mentioned, raising wages, 2 days late, 2 days later introducing massive changes in the budget, especially when it comes to subsidies. These are all of them, it seems at least from the outside, not based on a strategic vision on how to manage the deteriorated socioeconomic situation and how to manage it while the government is not willing to open up politically. And the government, to my knowledge, is not going to open up anytime soon because there is a succession issue going on which really is, as it is perceived from within the ruling establishment, prevents, hinders, and limits, in fact, the space and the power given to even reform-minded voices within the establishment to open up politically. Because the succession issue, the way, the different scenarios which are in discussion for how to transfer presidential power in 2011, probably maybe before 2011 or after 2011, because different scenarios which are being discussed are not settled, seem to be at least questioned, debated within the ruling establishment and outside. The succession issue which is going on really limits the capacity of the government to open up politically. And it's not simply because we're out of fear of the Muslim Brotherhood and what can the Brotherhood do, but it's out of fear of losing control, losing the firm grip which the regime did reestablish, reassert after 2005 over the political arena. Now, let me move to my remarks with regard to opposition movements or to the opposition spectrum, because as Behaye mentioned, I would like to differentiate between two components. One is the organized opposition spectrum, which is basically liberal leftist parties that we are looking at, as well as the Muslim Brotherhood. And the second component, which I would refer to as protest networks and movements. And here I would put Kefaya, in fact, in the same category, just like the group of Egyptian activists who organized April 6, who tried to organize May 4, Facebook activists, as they have come to be called in Egypt, al-Facebookiyin, which is quite, right. And so now, with regard to the organized opposition spectrum, and without going into details, the major outcome of different government measures in 06, 07 has been to weaken more and more the organized opposition spectrum. And here definitely it pertains to liberal and leftist parties, but it also pertains to the Muslim Brotherhood, because it would be misleading to, when you look at the Muslim Brotherhood and what it can do, how it sees, how it approaches Egyptian politics, how it articulates its actions as of now, you see a great difference between the movement as of now and the movement in 04, 05. Seems as if the different measures which the government took against the Brotherhood at least resulted in a moment of strategic imbalance. If you look at the Muslim Brotherhood and try to analyze their actions over the last 18 months or so, we are clearly looking at a movement in a moment of strategic imbalance. You see it clearly when you look at the debate over the draft party platform last fall. You see it clearly, as Behaye mentioned, how the movement managed the issue of strikes, April 6, no, May 4, yes. It's a movement in a moment of strategic imbalance, a sign of weakness, an additional sign of weakness. And the same applies for liberal and leftist movements, which are still faced with a great deal of restrictions, legal restrictions, as well as political restrictions when they try to organize or reach out to constituencies in Egypt. So we have a weakened opposition spectrum. The outcome of it is that basically these movements are not able to channel, to guide, to structure the social dynamism which we see out there in the Egyptian social fabric. April 6 was not organized. Even the contribution of Kefaya was highly limited. Not a single organized opposition movement, not a single organized political movement participated in organizing April 6. May 4, in spite of whatever the Muslim Brotherhood put out as a statement endorsing the strike, the sit-in on May 4, it didn't reach much, because once again, these movements are weakened and their ability to channel social dynamism has been highly diminished by different regime measures. And of course, I mean, there is a degree of their own failure in conceptualizing what's going on, but I'm not going to go into it. The risk of what's going on in Egypt, this distinction or this contradiction between weakened opposition movements and an ongoing, a growing social dynamism, in fact, outside the political arena proper. I mean, what happens in Egypt is there's a degree of transfer of the energy, which we did see in 04, 05, inside the political arena to outside it. What's happening really takes place outside the political arena. The greatest risk, when you look at it, is definitely the potential of unguided social dynamism going in too many different directions where no one can rule out the possibility of violent trends, militant ideas, militant alternatives, once again being transferred, being injected into the scene. In fact, there were two remarkable incidents over the last 8 weeks. A few weeks ago, the Egyptian security announced that they arrested, in fact, for the first time in 2 years in Egypt, a group of militant Islamists not affiliated to the Brotherhood and not affiliated to al-Jama'a al-Islamiyya or al-Jihad, but at least, according to security, those who were arrested claimed to be affiliated to al-Qaeda. And it's a group of young people. I mean, just to give you an idea of what's going on in the spectrum of Egyptian youth. Some of them are in Facebook, some of them are moderate, but some are not. And the second incident, which happened, if I'm not mistaken, almost 10 months ago, where once again the government security apparatus announced the arrest of a big group. It was over 15 of activists who were put in relation with al-Qaeda. So there are, if you look at it, a highly dynamic social fabric and very weak opposition movements and a government that is shutting off the political arena, this is not the recipe to face even the challenges of the coming years or even to create a political environment which is preferable to a succession scenario the government or the establishment might be debating. Now, the unorganized opposition spectrum, and as I said, we did have two waves. The first wave came with Kefaya and whatever Kefaya led to in terms of establishing different alliances for change in Egypt across the spectrum. And we seem to be into a second wave where young activists, some of them are journalists, some of them are NGOs members, some of them are human rights activists, are establishing new networks, protest networks. Now, they are creative. They are vibrant to try to organize, as Bahai mentioned, a strike on April 6th is quite significant. However, there are two structural limitations to whatever we can expect out of these networks. One, basically, that they lack any stable constituency. There are, be it you look at leftists, Bahai identified three groups which I would agree with: social left, liberals, and moderate Islamists. All of them lack constituencies. You are looking at groups of activists that cannot mobilize their constituencies, which is one explanation for why May 4, as opposed to April 6, did not turn out to be a great success. The second structural limitation of the unorganized opposition spectrum is basically out of good reasons, that many of them lack trust in the organized opposition. If you look at different reactions by activists, different reaction to the announcement of the Muslim Brotherhood to endorse May 4 and the strike on May 4, it was highly, highly rejectionist. There is a history of mistrust. When activists, young activists, or unorganized opposition elements look at the organized opposition, which seems from afar domesticated or not effective enough. Now, where do I see the unorganized opposition spectrum going in the coming, let us say, 1 to 2 years? I expect that we will see more of the activities. Egypt in 2007 witnessed over 1,000 labor strikes and sit-ins, which was remarkable. Egypt in 2006 witnessed roughly 800. In the last 4 months, we are looking at over 800 labor strikes and sit-ins in different Egyptian urban centers and rural areas. But in terms of the political significance of what's going on, there is not much to expect. What I am saying is the government has managed to weaken the organized opposition spectrum in an effective way. The unorganized opposition spectrum is not up to the challenge of generating pressure on the government to change the current political trajectory. So once again, it's left to the government. The only challenge which the Egyptian government is facing as of now is the social situation, is the deteriorated socioeconomic condition, and the fact that it overlaps with a critical political moment, which is the upcoming succession beyond 2011. So it's up to the government to decide how it's going to manage the tough socioeconomic environment, and it's up to it whether it's going to relate it to the succession issue to try to use political opening as a strategy or not. We'll have to keep an eye on it. But once again, very similar to 04 and 05, the opposition spectrum, the organized and unorganized components, its significance, its capacity to influence events in Egypt is highly limited.
Thank you all very, very much. I thought Facebook was a broken plural, which meant it would be Fawasbook, no, if it were pluralized. I think one of the most interesting and provocative elements of this panel is the variety of perspectives that we've heard about this relationship between the opposition on one hand and the government on the other, and the different characterizations we've heard about the kinds of capacities that the opposition is able to bring to bear in its relationship with the government and the extent to which the government is capable of managing those pressures. We've heard on one hand perspectives that stress the extent to which government responses are ad hoc, are limited, are not capable of fully managing the kinds of challenges that the opposition throws up, in part because the identity of the opposition has shifted in ways that have changed some of the problems that the regime is wrestling with away from the domains in which they had developed established responses into the socioeconomic domain where they are more vulnerable. We've heard that perspective. And on the other, we've heard from Bahai this notion of a counterattack in which through legislative and regulatory kinds of shifts, the government is actually trying to fundamentally restructure the balance of power between citizens and the state in Egypt, perhaps driven by a short-term concern with the immediate demands of a succession moment, but with implications for political liberty and political mobilization in Egypt that go well beyond the immediate moment. And so there has been, I think, a really fabulous set of presentations that lay out how difficult it is to unpack and get a handle on precisely what the current circumstances are offering both to the opposition and the kinds of opportunities it presents to them and risks on one hand, and the same as well for the government. And I hope we'll have a chance to pursue some of those themes in the questions. I'd be happy to begin taking questions now. What I would like to do is to invite everyone with a question to identify yourself and your organization. Please do keep your questions as questions. And if you would like, you may also direct a question to a particular member of the panel. Sir.
Thank you very much. I'm Mu'taz Zahran. I'm from the Embassy of Egypt. And I'm delighted to be here to listen to this panel and the views they've expressed. Just one comment at the beginning on the title of this event, Deteriorating Politics and Social Unrest in Egypt. The title itself, we've been told so many times that provocative titles bring in audience. And if this is the rationale behind having such a provocative title, then I see from the attendance in the room here that you've succeeded. On few issues that have been mentioned, let me just say very quickly, and I'm sorry if I'm not asking a question, this kind of debate we've seen here, when I first read the title, of course, what a dark picture is going to be painted today on what's going on. Listen to the comments. There is there somewhere some glimpses, at least from the points of view of those on the panel, that there is a kind of light somewhere there in what they say, especially when Michel referred to some of the measures that have been taken to address the crisis of the food crisis. The food crisis, let me just say that it's a global crisis. Shorten the comment. Okay. It's a global crisis. Egypt's economy is still in developing, and the impact of the crisis on an economy like Egypt would be, of course, greater than the impact on the economy of the United States, for example. Egypt is a food net importing country, and thus the impact has been a bit stronger. Let me say that the kind of debate that has or is going to take place today is the kind of debate you would also see and witness and live in Egypt itself. So it's nothing different than what you would see there. Very quickly, judges have been referred to. I have judges in the family, and I have a knowledge of what the judiciary looks like. There is a draft I know that is intended to put more emphasis on the independence of the judiciary and to delineate the roles and the competences of both ministries of justice and judges. Military trials have been referred to where civilians are brought into trial. Well, when a civilian uses measures of violence and militia type approaches to political life in Egypt, then a military trial is there. I know organizations like Amnesty, for example, would argue against having a civilian. Ayman Noor has been referred to. That is a trial that has been taken place in the open. Police torture, what I know, is zero tolerance, not to freedom of assembly and speech, but I know that there is an open policy of zero tolerance to abuses. And I've been living for the last year getting news on police officers being brought to trial on abuse charges, which is something very significant and shouldn't be overlooked in a society like Egypt. I wouldn't like to add more, just to maybe one thing, constitutional amendments, notion of citizenship, multi-candidate presidential elections. Let me also say the laying of the grounds for the abolition of the emergency laws in Egypt and bringing in an anti-terror law. And Michel has referred to when exactly or how or what are the possibilities. This is yet to be seen, but I wouldn't like to take much time from the panel. Thank you.
Najib Gadban, University of Arkansas. I actually would like to challenge the theme of the panel and the description of Bahiyyeddin of these measures counterattack, but on a different ground from Mr. Zahran. Isn't it more accurate to say what we witness in Egypt is more going back to business as usual, and the period of 2005-2006 was more, you know, like a liberalized period in which you need to have a legislative election, so, you know, that would lay the ground for another term for the president. That's my first kind of question. The second question, if any of you could address the whole idea of factions within the regime, especially maybe Jamal Mubarak. Where does he stand when his reform-minded policy committee on measures like these? I mean, we know in the Arab world, in laying the ground for succession, that the fathers are supposed to ruin the country and the, you know, the sons are supposed to repair it. Thank you.
Why don't we take one more? Joe, why don't you?
Thank you, Joe Stork, Human Rights Watch. Actually, I have two questions, if I may. One, regarding the emergency law and the draft counterterrorism law, I'm wondering if any of you see any significant difference between them, and whether the any passage of what's likely to be a counterterrorism law is likely to have any, I mean, any difference in the dynamics you've been describing. Secondly, you've all referred in one way or another to the labor strikes or the that element. And but yet in talking about the loci of opposition, none of you mentioned the trade union movement. And I'm just wondering, is that because you don't see anything there? Is there was talk a year or so ago about possibility of an independent trade union movement emerging? I'd like you to comment on that.
We'll answer these and then return to the floor panel.
Okay, let me. I'm going to leave emergency counterterrorism differences to Bahai. I guess he is the best equipped among us to address it. My impression is that there is no big difference. I read what was leaked in Al-Masri Al-Yom a few weeks ago, and it's as depressing as the amended Article 179 of the Egyptian Constitution, which is basically, in a way, doing away with the emergency law while making many provisions of the emergency law constitutional in Article 179 and definitely in the counterterrorism law. Let me address two points. One on what Mu'taz referred to, and while acknowledging, of course, the tough job in which he is, and in a way, it's not easy for an Egyptian official as of now to address the issue of social unrest, which is taking place. It's not invented by the panel. We have seen several signs over the last weeks, if not 2 years, and of course a deteriorating political arena where once again we have seen several signs at many different levels, legal, political, daily management of politics. And here I'm going to tie Najib's question to Mu'taz. So I would argue very much against the notion of it's moving ahead, Egypt is reforming, the reform process is going on. This could have been said in 04 and 05. When you look at 06, 07, and 08, we are definitely into a moment of backslide, setback, regression, whatever you label it. And it's not back to business as usual. I fear it's even worse, because we did have, under Mubarak, between 81 and 08, several moments where business was usual, but where space was left in the political arena for different opposition movements, including the Muslim Brotherhood, to articulate and participate in the game in one way or another. Right now, we are in a moment of a highly aggressive attitude, and it's by no means restricted to the Muslim Brotherhood. Bahai's reference to the two NGOs, human rights organizations, which were closed. What's happening with the independent press, Ibrahim Issa, in fact, as of now, while we speak. What's happening with regard to those who organized the April 6th strike, that the government security forces arrested Isra Abdul Rahman, who is 24, 25, and basically had an account on Facebook and try to help organizing April 6th, to arrest Isra Abdul Rahman, who is not connected to any movement, who is not an activist in the Muslim Brotherhood, and put her in jail for 2 weeks. These are, to my mind, it's a bit more than going back to business as usual, and one reason to explain why it's a bit more is definitely the succession issue. They are trying to keep the grip, which they re-established over the political arena after 05, where it seems that was going in a different direction. They are trying to keep it as firm as possible until the succession issue is clarified. Second, definitely to refer to military trials and try to in any way to find an apologetic or even explanatory discourse. This is really, I mean, quite disturbing in a country where everyone, and not only activists of the Muslim Brotherhood, including Bahai himself and his center, which put out different declarations calling for on the government to finally abolish the military tribunals and different extrajudicial measures which the government keeps resorting to, and so it's not business as usual. It's a bit more. Second point on the issue of opposition and government and what's going on. Once again, I guess the real impediment for the opposition is the fact that the organized opposition has been weakened substantially, and all of them in different ways are really in a moment of strategic imbalance. Do not expect much from them. Social dynamism, as long as we do not have real constituencies behind it, among them are trade unions, the labor movement, which is still up until now very well controlled and contained by the government. As long as we do not have real constituencies behind the social dynamism which is going on, they are bound not to produce enough pressures on the government to change course. So what I guess we will have more of the disconnect between a deteriorated socioeconomic situation and a process of shutting off the political space and closing it for opposition movements as well as activists or unorganized elements.
Yeah, I have three answers for two questions. And the comment on what Amr has said concerning the context of the succession. Concerning the question of Naguib Radwan, and I agree with Amr has said, but I would like to draw your attention that we have in this regard not business as usual, just business as usual, but a process of re-engineering the society based in very serious constitutional amendments which go back behind the slight improvement which took place by the Constitution of 71. And therefore, I said that this is the worst constitution setback since July 52. And also, in addition to such constitutional amendments, there are several legislative amendments, new laws, and so on, and mainly concerning not only anti-terrorism law, and this is how it affects the situation, but also concerning the judiciary system, to make it more controlled, and also there are more and more coming in the tracts concerning the freedom of the press, the NGOs law, which is, we thought that it is repressive enough, but there is more and more coming. Concerning the just question on the anti-terrorism law, it is not the same like emergency law. Of course, we don't have a official version, but there are a version which I'm referred to. But whatever would be the final version or the official version of this law, the main difference that this is a normalization of the emergency state to make it not emergence and based on the same foundations of the emergency law. Second, this is protected and covered by the Constitution and itself, which was amended mainly to grant or to provide such constitutional cover. So in this regard, this is much more dangerous And in fact, human rights defenders in Egypt and many others, if we have to choose, we will say, please keep the state of emergency. At least this is maybe changed or end tomorrow, after tomorrow, but having such normal law, between brackets, this is much more negative and has more impact. Concerning the question of succession, Amr has explained what is going on in Egypt, that this is a requirement to secure the succession. Should be the only answer. I mean to secure the succession. Because if we go back to the Moroccan example, how one of the most bloodiest kings in the Arab region, Hassan II, has secured the constitutional succession to his son. This king, at the beginning of the 90s, started a large process of political openness just to secure this succession, in spite that this is provided by the constitution. But he realized that securing succession in such very repressive environment, it is very dangerous for the continuity of the same regime. So, in fact, the political reform which made in Morocco, it wasn't started by King Mohammed VI. It started at the hand of the King Hassan II. Thank you.
Briefly, Najib's point about Gamal Mubarak and his group and so forth. I don't like to play up a lot this sort of new guard, old guard, you know, within the regime or within the ruling party differences. But there definitely is a group, you know, around Gamal Mubarak. They're very interested in modernizing the country. I mean, they're interested in globalization, increasing Egypt's global competitiveness. And they've had sort of a, you know, scientific approach to this, so the economic reforms they want to carry out and social reforms, and some of them go fairly far in terms of eventually getting out of the business of subsidies and getting into welfare payments instead and all these kind of things. But I think they've been able to do the things they wanted to do, as Amr noted, on the macroeconomic front. And those have brought certain results. But they're also a bit frustrated, and I think right now their hands are being forced, you know, by the social unrest, by the fact that the benefits haven't trickled down, and then we see the global economic situation, global economic food crisis, fuel crisis, and they've had to react to those things. On political reform, I've never thought this was something that particularly motivated Gamal Mubarak and his group. They've certainly have done some of it, but I think recently we've seen them become sort of less willing to countenance competition than they might have been a few years ago. I think the 05 elections were a wake-up call for them, and we've seen them, and even in my conversations with people, I see people being, you know, much more concerned about the brotherhood and so forth than they might have been in the past. So I don't necessarily see Gamal Mubarak and his group pushing for political reform within ruling circles.
Let me take three more questions, people already on the list, and then we'll also perhaps have a chance for our panelists to have a final word before we close. Sir, you in the gray suit.
Yeah. Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. So far you've been discussing this issue solely in the domestic context, but Egypt lives in an international environment. The president recently said in Israel, we should not appease Iran. Okay, appeasement by Winston Churchill with regard to Germany was a criticism that the war with Germany was unavoidable. Better to have had the war in 1938 at Munich than wait a year and allow the military situation to deteriorate. Sounds an awful lot like the doctrine of preemption. So my question to you is, if this situation develops, if the war expands, what impact would that have on the domestic situation in Egypt?
Thank you. Ma'am in the front. Could you identify yourself, please?
Oh, sure. Mervat Hatem, Howard University. I want to follow up on Joe's question about labor unions. We've been witnessing like more than a year of labor strikes, and the numbers involved are huge. Thousands of people. And not only that, the labor union strikes have encouraged the tax auditors as well as the doctors to begin to entertain the process of striking. Now, you may not think that this is an important political constituency and that it's an economic constituency, but clearly it is an economic constituency that is politically available for mobilization if there are connections between its demands, like for the right to strike, for instance, collective bargaining. All of these are very important concepts for the idea of political reform, in other words, expanding the political space. But as usual, I mean, it's very difficult to gear the discussion of political reform to workers and the kind of impact that they may actually have on increasing the available political space. I realize that the government has basically tried to buy them off, and that has succeeded for a while, but it doesn't look like it is succeeding in settling this. And therefore, I really would like you to examine the impact that labor strikes and the strikes by doctors, tax auditors. I mean, it doesn't seem to be, we're not going to witness an end to this, and how this is likely to impact on the political space, the free political space.
Thank you. Last question to Rick here in the front.
Thank you. Ricky Goldstein, Human Rights Watch. Two questions. First, is there in the current climate a risk of increased sectarian tensions? Is anybody in this context fanning the flames of Muslim-Coptic tension? And the second question on foreign policy, you've often referred to the period of 2000-2005, and during that period, the U.S. was more vocal in criticizing Egypt for its human rights record. And I remember, Bahe, that during that period, although you're not a fan of U.S. policy generally, you welcomed that kind of vocal engagement. And, of course, the climate has changed now, and also the U.S. discourse has changed. And I wonder, in the current climate, whether a more vocal U.S. on public liberties issues or a more vocal EU could reverse or slow down the backsliding you describe.
Thank you. The question about the implications for Egypt of deepening of regional conflict. Any takers?
I'll say one thing about it. You know, of course, the perception of external threats, you know, often has a unifying effect and so forth. And if the regional situation were really to blow up a lot more than it already has, it would have that effect in Egypt to some extent. But I feel as though in Egypt we're a bit beyond that, that people have really become very consumed with domestic issues, be they economic, social, political, and that, you know, short of Egypt's borders being attacked or something, which I don't think is in the cards, that I couldn't see external, security situations in the region totally taking the focus of Egyptians off their domestic issues, because, you know, despite the Palestinian issue throughout, you know, the Second Intifada, the invasion of Iraq, and so forth, we saw Egyptians, you know, certainly getting upset about those issues, protesting about those issues, but even often then turning it around to then protest against the government and so forth. So I will just say that I think these domestic issues are going to continue to be very salient in Egypt, even if the regional situation becomes more tense.
I agree with what Michelle said. There is one component of the regional situation which has great domestic implication, which is the situation in Gaza. I guess if there is one component in the wider regional scene which has clear domestic impacts, be it you look at the level of national security, real national security considerations, which Egypt does have and which the government rightly put forward few weeks ago, as a couple of incidents, in fact, a Hamas attack on the borders took place, or be it you look at the levels of government opposition dynamics. One of the outcomes of what happened in Gaza a few weeks ago was an attempt, rhetorically but on the ground, by the government to bring in the Muslim Brotherhood, to blame the Muslim Brotherhood for what Hamas did, and to once again initiate a new wave of repression. So Gaza has a great deal of impacts.
Concerning a potential war, this would be a great reward for the current regimes in the region and also for the political Islamists. I think those would be the most benefited from such a war against Iran, as far as I understand you, your question. Concerning the escalation of tension between Copts and Muslims, it has taken place since a long time, and there is not yet feasible policy to deal with such alarming situation. Even to deal positively with some of the recommendation of the state institution of human rights, which is the National Council of Human Rights. Sir, the question concerning from Ricky concerning the focal talk of U.S. and Europe concerning the human rights and democracy. As I referred at the very beginning, this was one of the main features of the which accompanied the political mobility of 2004 and 2005. This new stage of this second wave of protest movement, there is and additional indications of difference that it has, I can say that the Muslim Brotherhood as a weapon in the hands of the government to deal whatever with its internal public or with the international community has become less valid in such context. And because there are other new faces and forces have become at the front. Also, another outside observation is concerning the oppositional political parties, which also have become less visible for the Egyptian society in general and for the new generation in particular. Thank you very much.
You. Amr, on
question on labor unrest. I definitely agree. I mean, what we are looking at is an economic constituency, bread and butter issues. In fact, if you look at what happened over the last weeks, different groups which organize worker protest activities resisted the politicization of their platform. I mean, there was an attempt by Kfaya and by the Muslim Brotherhood in different ways to politicize labor unrest, and they resisted the politicization, which
to my mind, comes from two directions. One, as I said, the history of mistrust in political actors out of good reasons. I mean, they haven't delivered. They promised it's not only the government which is not delivering. Opposition movements haven't delivered as well. And secondly, because politicizing labor unrest risks making it a confrontation between the government and major opposition movements where even sort of where workers fear that the government will no longer be at least submitting to some of their claims by raising wages here, bringing down, by sort of addressing socioeconomic grievances behind them. So we have an economic constituency, but since we lack organized political actors to, in a convincing way, to penetrate the scene, to make an economic, to make out of an economic constituency a political constituency, the immediate political significance is not there. It's an important trajectory, it's an important phenomenon, which we have to keep an eye on, but if you are looking at the coming 2 to 4 years, I don't see it becoming politically more visible or more significant. One final point on sort of the Gamal group. Because one, I mean, I agree with what Michel said. We really have a gap between economic and political reform, commitment by the group to economic and political reform. But one more structural issue which is more relevant is if you look at Egypt as of now, we are witnessing in an unprecedented way an expansion of the domestic roles of the security apparatus. It would be misleading to look at the Gamal group or the NDP as the main actor in managing Egyptian domestic politics. They are not. They are one actor. They are one group. But we have an expansion of the different domestic roles by the security apparatus in too many different ways. I mean, they are not only an integral part of how the regime, how the government manages the domestic scene, they are becoming a leading component of the management of the domestic scene. So in even imagining Gamal and his group committed to political reform, the security apparatus is not on their side and is limiting the space given to them and has used effectively the outcome of the parliamentary election in 2005 in signaling to whoever is reform-minded in Gamal's group that this is not the way which Egypt should take, at least until 2011.
Well, in that case, let me thank all of you for joining us for what has been, I think, an extraordinarily interesting conversation about the current state of Egyptian politics, political economy, and society. And let me thank all of our panelists for terrific presentations.